Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the sound. It's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning public affairs program for the people on this Memorial Day weekend. We're bringing you even more information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. This morning, we're going to welcome another surviving parent of one of the Sandy Hook victims to our program for the first time. We're going to head out into the field, quite literally, for a candid chat with Jenny Hubbard from the site of the Catherine Violet Hubbard Animal Sanctuary to talk about how that project is promoting resilience in the Newtown community and Catherine's joy and dreams of helping animals in distress. Then we'll dial in to chat with the director of the New Haven Health Department to learn why the Elm City is among the latest to engage in the National Healthiest Cities and Counties Challenge and mounting a comprehensive game plan to combat the escalating number of kids and residents suffering from asthma. Then we'll wrap up talking urological health and cancer prevention, along with inviting you to participate in this year's 5K walk and run to benefit the Center for Cancer Care at Griffin Hospital coming up on June 4th. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this news. 4 days in June, plus nearly 500 pizzas donated by many of the greater New Haven's best and most generous pizzerias, plus great music on the New Haven Green, courtesy of the International Festival of Arts and Ideas, plus thousands of hungry pizza and music lovers looking for lunch. All this adds up to the 21st annual Greater New Haven Pizza Fest, supporting programs and services of The Connection. This year's Pizza Fest is going to be held on June 16th and 17th and June 23rd and 24th from noon to 1:30 on the New Haven Green during the International Festival of Arts and Ideas free lunchtime concerts. Pizza's just $3 a slice, Italian ice is $2, and soda and water are $1. Come on down and enjoy authentic New Haven pizza for a good cause.
Well, we don't get out into the country very much on the award-winning For the People, and when we do, it's usually for something really, really important. So today is no different. We're so pleased and proud to both be welcomed up to the Catherine Violet Hubbard Foundation's animal rescue operation, which is in its early stages of ramping up here in Newtown, but also pleased to be the guest of Jenny Hubbard. Since its inception in 2013, the Catherine Violet Hubbard Foundation and the subsequent decision to create an animal sanctuary in Catherine's memory has continued to make significant progress towards building a place that reflects Catherine's kindness and compassion. They've crossed some significant milestones, and as we are going to hear today, there's some really exciting things on the road ahead. So without further ado, let me bring on to mic Jenny Hubbard. And as many listening may know, sadly, Catherine was lost in the Sandy Hook shootings. So here we are today in 2016, and Catherine's never far from our minds, but we also have this fantastic project to celebrate. So, Jenny, thanks for having us. And tell us a little bit of the story post-1214 and how this all came together for folks that aren't familiar with it.
Yeah. So we made a decision, Matt and I, my husband made a decision that we wanted to really focus on honoring Catherine's life. Mm-hmm. And that's where we felt our healing would come from. So it really started with her obituary. We asked that donations in her memory go to the Animal Center. And the Animal Center received close to $125,000within a month time frame. They held the money for us and came to us and had shared with us the idea of creating a sanctuary. And pre-1214, we had a dog, we had a bunny, and we had a fish. That was the extent of our rescue knowledge. So as they explained what a sanctuary stood for and what it embodied, we really felt Catherine and knew that you know, who knows what her life would have led. The one constant that we know, it would have involved animals. Just because her spirit was just to embrace all living things.
So I guess it wasn't long before you had kind of a crash course education in the fact that there are just a huge amount of viable, friendly, lovable animals who have had productive lives on farms and at homes in Connecticut, who may have outgrown their owners or sadly outgrown the ability for those owners to keep them or the space they live in. And this kind of, I guess, provided one of the keys to the door that has brought us here today.
Mm-hmm. It evolved as we started learning about rescues, learning about needs. It evolved into what we have today, which is, you know, the sanctuary and really three components of that being exactly what you said, caring for animals. We're going to focus our attention on senior dogs and cats, companion animals that may be displaced because their caregivers aren't able to provide or aren't getting the care that they need. So we're gonna provide shelter for those animals. We're gonna provide sanctuary for farm animals that are otherwise displaced. Farms are being closed all over the state, and those animals need a place to live out the remainder of their days, and they can do it here at the sanctuary. And then long term, we want to provide some support to the Animal Control Center and really work with wildlife experts to be able to do rehabilitative and release wild back into nature. That's long term. But short term, the barn refurb is going to support some of the farm animals. And we've just launched a senior paws. It's called the Senior Paws Project. It's actually helping animals without having a brick and mortar. We facilitate fosters through our senior community. And we take dogs from Dawes down in Danbury. And those senior dogs are sitting in their shelters. They're now placed in a home. We just had our first foster, Wally. So it's
great.
So
this is really diversified, you know, all under sort of the same careful and loving eye as your daughter had, into really kind of fulfilling, it seems like, virtually every optional path that one could take toward trying to take the best care of both the domestic animals, the farm animals, and the added benefit of familiarizing either former or folks who never had a dog before with the joy of an adult pet.
We really feel like at the sanctuary, what we're doing is creating a partnership between people and animals. And I feel like that's what makes this place special because of Catherine's just love and embracing and acceptance of all beings. So we really feel like if we can enrich the lives of all beings by being compassionate, being accepting, and finding a purpose, embracing the purpose, then we're honoring Catherine and what she stood for.
Great. Well, before we talk a little bit about some of the physical spaces on the property where we're sitting here in Newtown, let's talk a little bit about the unique gift that, I mean, you know, I don't want to dwell on the fact that, you know, Governor Malloy played such a critical role on that horrible day in the days since, but one of the things that he and the Newtown delegation of state representatives and other offices and officials in the state were able to do was to create a situation that has seldom, if ever, happened before in the state of Connecticut, and that is bequesting property so that you guys could do this here.
Yeah, we were grateful for the support of the entire state legislature, all of our local representatives. They really worked with us in understanding the process and helping us vet our business plan and the sanctuary, what our focus was going to be through legislature to have the land conveyed over over to the foundation. It was humbling. And one thing that I was certainly proud of was that we had gone in there with the expectation that, you know, we wanted to make sure that whatever we did was sustaining. I mean, the worst thing we can do is to create a place where it now becomes a burden on the community.
Right,
and that's not going to happen.
And some of the things that were happening under state ownership, the agricultural uses of part of the parcel will mm-hmm. still continue?
Yeah. So our goal with the property is to restore it to its original grandeur. So yeah. we've solicited the support of UConn and their invasive plant department. So they've created a land management plan that addresses invasives. And we're using their expertise. We're working with the Audubon with their meadow managers. So our goal is to just restore the property to what it once was and not to make it a commercial development.
Right. We're about halfway through our chat with Jenny Hubbard this morning. We are out in the field in the middle of the Catherine Violet Hubbard Animal Sanctuary. If you'd like to learn more, honestly, this location is, as they say on their website, a beacon to like-minded individuals that share a passion for wanting to connect, grow, and learn together in a really encouraging environment. There's educational workshops and exciting activities. There's opportunities to come in and be a volunteer to help build or maintain. Certainly, animal care professionals will be among their growing volunteer ranks in the future. Anything you want to know about the Catherine Violet Hubbard Foundation or the sanctuary, you can begin to learn about by visiting their website, cvhfoundation.org. We're with Jenny Hubbard, Catherine's mom, here at the foundation site today. So we came up a long dirt road, a partially paved road, and now we're sitting under a very interesting structure that kind of rises up out of the middle of a field that they call the pavilion. Jenny, is this structure that we're sitting in sort of just a gathering place, or will we have walls and ceilings built around us eventually?
It's a model of the pavilion that will welcome all people who visit the sanctuary. This is the threshold to the property.
Okay.
And then off either side will be the educational component, and then our veterinary intake building. And the pavilion symbolizes Catherine.
Mm-hmm.
And the buildings, the animal and the people building, represent, and they're adjoined by a colonnade.
Mm-hmm.
So that colonnade represents her arms, welcoming people and animals alike.
Okay.
This was a gift to the foundation when the land was conveyed. And it really represented a change of guard here at the sanctuary. It represents Catherine standing watch.
Oh, okay.
Eventually, it will be moved into the woods and be the walls for vines. These will be the beams.
Yes.
And we hope that it will become a secret garden where kids can just find it, kind of stumble upon. There won't be a memorial garden here because we really want this to be a place that embodies life and hope.
Yeah.
So we thought it would be great if people just stumble upon it, that in its elegance, they'll meet Catherine. They'll encounter Catherine here.
That's great.
Yeah.
So let's look at the three steps. First, what's going on as we speak mm-hmm. is another unique partnership with another great national, regional nonprofit. Mm-hmm. Tell us quickly about what's going on with the barn.
Mm-hmm. So our goal is to restore the property, and part of the property is this barn. It's a three-story bank barn. Rescue, Rebuild, and the Greater Good organization raised the money to refurbish the barn. Mm-hmm. We didn't want to take it down. It was built in the late 1800s.
Mm.
And it's a post and beam barn. So what they're doing right now is restoring the barn to a point that it's going to stop the rot.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom, the sills were gone. It had just been overrun with graffiti. So they've been here for 2 weeks. They're going to restore it. They're going to take away anything that was added onto it, and we're going to let the barn breathe for as long as we need. Yeah.
And so what will be the next sort of structural or construction component of the sanctuary?
Mm-hmm. So we're going to start permitting and the zoning process. The main building and the vet intake building will be our first phase.
Mm-hmm.
We can do everything out of those two buildings. Eventually, we'd love to add a learning facility, possibly tree houses.
Mm-hmm.
But those pieces and parts will be when the timing's right.
Organically,
absolutely,
emerge
as they're needed.
Yeah.
But the vet intake and the educational building here, right off the pavilion, will be what we build.
Okay.
And then just restoring the meadows. All of the invasive needs to be replaced with native plants.
Yeah.
We've got this Connecticut Butterfly Association is helping us create meadows that will help butterflies that are endangered right now, and hopefully mark it as a monarch sanctuary so that it will help the migration down to Mexico.
Great.
It's cool.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So what is the ETA for having the level of intake of animals that you eventually envision will be sort of the course of doing business for the sanctuary?
Mm-hmm. It all depends on the permitting piece.
Yeah.
3 years ago, I would have given you a time.
Yeah.
3 years ago, I had this place built by Catherine's first birthday after she died.
I see.
So, now our goal is to be through the permitting process this year,
okay.
Start construction in 2017, being mindful that if it doesn't happen, that's okay. Because
yeah.
we want to be thoughtful about the choices that we make and the progress that we take on the property. It's a beautiful piece of property. We want to do it right.
Okay. And at the same time, Catherine is reaching out through you and the many volunteers and touching the lives of a lot of kids, not just kids in Newtown, but folks are coming from mm-hmm. all over the place to these occasional workshops and demonstrations that you're having here. Was that originally part of the plan, or did that come on in process?
It's grown organically. It was not part of the plan. When the land was conveyed, we really felt like this is a beautiful, beautiful place that kids can learn. So we've been hosting workshops. We just did backyard chickens. It's great. The schools come here with some of their walking field trips.
Mm-hmm.
So things that are happening here just seem to naturally evolve.
Mm-hmm.
And we look at it and we try it out, and if it doesn't work, we know that we won't do it again. But most of our workshops we hold monthly.
Excellent.
People come from as far as New York.
Mm. Well, we hope we'll be visiting with you and keeping our listeners across the state up to date on what's going on regularly here at the sanctuary. But say in the next, into and through the summer, what are some of the things that folks from around the state and wherever they may be listening, what are some things that they could do if they're interested in either coming out to experience it or perhaps digging in a little deeper and providing some assistance?
Yeah, they can visit the website, as you shared, cvhfoundation.org. We have a butterfly party on June 4th. It's our flagship event. It's a super adoption event in Newtown. 12 rescues. You can come and help a dog find or a cat find mm-hmm. a forever home. That's June 4th. If you want to volunteer on the barn, they're going to be here for another week. And then our website details all of the upcoming events through the summer.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Very good. We appreciate you taking some time to talk with us and all the folks listening. Jenny Hubbard is the mom of Catherine Violet Hubbard, who we sadly lost on 12/14 at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Her foundation has continued to make significant progress toward building a place that's going to reflect her kindness and compassion and her love for animals. The Catherine Violet Hubbard Animal Sanctuary is in its early stages of what sounds like is going to be a very unique, even a one-of-a-kind safe haven and place of healing and support for animals in need and all the folks who love and care for them in honoring Catherine. So, Jenny, we thank you for making time today to speak with us. CVHFoundation.org is their website where you can learn all there is to know about the foundation and get involved, keep tabs on their upcoming activities, which will begin to grow as the facilities and other stations here at the sanctuary begin to grow. Jenny, thanks so much for having us this morning.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
Well, we're pleased to welcome a brand new friend to the award-winning For the People, but he has been in service to the city of New Haven for some time. We're talking in just a few moments with the director of the City of New Haven Health Services. Dr. Byron Kennedy is with us on the line. The City of New Haven Health Department has joined the Healthiest Cities and Counties Challenge, a nationwide initiative encouraging small to mid-sized cities, counties, and tribes to create positive health impacts in their communities. New Haven joined the challenge as an early adopter, or something called an innovator city, with plans to significantly change the number of parents and children, specifically with asthma, who smoke, and reduce the number of children with asthma exposed to secondhand smoke and other environmental pollutants and triggers through the New Haven Asthma Alliance. Regular listeners to the program know that this is a subject that we've been talking about for a long time on the award-winning For the People, and we're pleased to have the latest agency and leader of it who is going to work for the better health of New Haven, particularly its children, and addressing the issue of secondhand smoke. So with that, we'll bring Dr. Byron Kennedy onto the line. Dr. Kennedy, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy to be here.
Good. So first, talk me through the process and decision-making when the opportunity to join the Healthiest Cities and Counties Challenge came to your attention.
Yeah, certainly. So when we actually heard about, you know, this opportunity, we already had been doing work maybe around asthma as a community initiative. And with, you know, the Asthma maybe Alliance, you know, we have certain partners already who've been engaged in having discussions about what we can do to address a very important issue here in this community. That included our hospitals, the City of New Haven, you know, including the health department, but not exclusively that, our Board of Education, community providers, and then many, many others, because maybe who care maybe about children, specifically children who have asthma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so in the City of New Haven, we have a disproportionate maybe burden of asthma here, and that's reflected in a number of indicators. For example, the hospitalization rate for asthma in New Haven is about 75 per 10,000 residents, and you contrast that with, let's say, the state average, which is only about 14 per 10,000.
Mm.
So that really maybe suggests maybe that the burden here in this community is substantially greater than elsewhere in the state. And when you think about hospitalizations for asthma, oftentimes the hospitalizations is used as a proxy of severity. In many cases, you may have a family that takes their child, you know, who's having an asthmatic attack to the emergency room. And when they're there, they may receive, you know, a nebulizing treatment that they respond to. And if they respond well, a decision may be made for that family to go home. On the other hand, you may have a child who's not responding, you know, and a decision could be made to have that child admitted. So when you're actually talking about the kids who've been admitted, who've been hospitalized, that generally is an indicator of more severity. Because, you know, they didn't maybe respond to initial treatment that might have occurred, you know, let's say, in the emergency room.
Mm-hmm.
So that being said, we know that perhaps the severity in this community is even worse than, let's say, Hartford, Bridgeport, Waterbury, and the other large urban metro areas.
Mm.
And, in fact, you know, our rates are among some of the highest, you know, in the Northeast.
So let me, let me stop you there. Just ask a question. Do you feel that the admission of that child through the ER for asthma-related complications or more acute asthma issues, do you feel that that is sort of, the magic passageway to provide that child or avail that child to a much greater suite of analysis and services and perhaps lengthy or even lifelong asthma response treatment or therapies?
Asthma, you know, is a chronic disease. And so generally speaking, when somebody is diagnosed and if they have had it maybe as a child, they may continue to have it throughout the rest of their life.
Mm.
And so with that being said, you know, having, if you will, you know, different, you know, educational programs and also knowing how to self-manage,
mm-hmm.
or how the management occurs in the case of a household, where it's not only maybe the child, but their family members who are helping them with that, but also thinking about people who are also interacting with that child. And that includes certainly folks in the school, whether those are teachers and principals, but, you know, also including school nurses.
Mm.
You have a significant role with any child who has asthma. because sometimes, you know, those attacks maybe occur, you know, while they are in class or while they're on the playground.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing what to do and how to manage and how to provide education about self-management are critical. So I think, you know, in a situation like what we have here in New Haven, being able to emphasize maybe those core strategies and have people coordinate those efforts together. Rather than having different silos.
So what I'm thinking I'm hearing is that the hospitalization of a child for the first time for an asthma related emergency may or may not provide a portal to greater support and wrapping of that child in the necessary education and services and medical intervention needed to monitor and control that asthma in the future.
Ideally, we would like to say that should be a great opportunity, but unfortunately, you know, as you know, the reality is perhaps it's not happening maybe all the time, so some of those opportunities are not being realized.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry to interrupt you. So you were talking now about the whole world of this child essentially being involved in both monitoring and potentially helping to intervene or educate and perhaps protect that child from more acute asthma attacks.
Absolutely. I mean, the first and foremost, I guess, person, you know, who's caring for that child is the primary care provider, oftentimes the pediatrician. And many times the pediatrician will have what's called like an asthma action plan in place. And that basically maybe is a guiding document that, you know, looks at what a child's symptoms might be and based upon where they are and their symptoms, what's the appropriate treatment for them to take at that point in time. Unfortunately, a lot of that information may not necessarily be known, let's say, to the school system, including the school nurses. And yet, you know, that's where a child spends a disproportionate amount of their time, especially during the school year. So being able to have, if you will, maybe more sharing of information, let's say, from that pediatrician's office to our school nurses will be maybe huge in terms of being able to provide a great environment for that child and for that family.
Mm.
So those are some of the things, you know, that we've identified as current major points, anchor points, if you will, that we want to focus on in this community to help move the dial.
Okay. So as part of joining the Healthiest Cities and Counties Challenge as an early adopter or innovator city, that leads me to the conclusion that you and your department and all of the many partners that you have already engaged, you know, may already be steps ahead of other communities that may have around the same or even higher per capita incidence of asthma?
I think so. And I think, and certainly the fact that we were selected, you know, for this challenge really reflects, you know, favorably on us as a community compared to others across the country who also applied, I guess, maybe for this. You know, so I think that we are in a good position to kind of like maybe show what we're hoping maybe to achieve during this next maybe 2-year phase period, you know, when they will be having multiple opportunities for the selected communities to share what they are achieving along the way with one another.
Mm.
I mean, one of the important things that we're hoping to institute, you know, for instance, just this summer, is having, if you will, summer asthma camps for kids who have asthma, particularly maybe for those who are more likely to be hospitalized or just to go to the emergency room. You know, part of that you will be doing in conjunction with the City Department of Parks and Recreation, with our health department, where we will have a nurse who will be on site during these camps in order to provide, if you will, education to those students about how to use their inhalers, when to use them appropriately. But then I think being in a camp is great because it allows maybe that child maybe to know that there's somebody else like them, another kid like them who has asthma. And then beyond just having asthma, who also needs to use their inhaler appropriately, whether that's for rescue or whether that's maybe for maintenance. Because we all know that, you know, many kids are influenced maybe by their peers. And so in some instances, if you're on the playground and you're running, do you really want to be that kid, you know, who has asthma, or let alone the kid who's carrying a device that you have to use because you have difficulty breathing?
Mm-hmm.
So by having a camp like this, it allows a peer support system to be developed and hopefully even friendships that will last a long time. And then that helps maybe normalize that it's okay to have asthma and then it's okay maybe to use your inhaler when you need to.
Mm-hmm.
So we think that will be maybe critical, if you will, to sort of changing, if you will, behavior and changing the culture around asthma, particularly for kids.
Yeah,
what we're also going to do is, ahead of the next school year, is provide an intensive training to the school nurses. Because quite frankly, maybe our school nurses are in a unique situation because of their relationship with the students, the families, and the pediatricians, to be in a position to better recognize when there are symptoms going on and what to do about that, particularly in the school setting, but not exclusively there.
Excellent. Dr. Kennedy, I wanted to just ask you to stay with us for a moment while we take a quick midpoint break. We've got about 5 or 6 minutes left to speak with Dr. Byron Kennedy. He's Director of Health for the New Haven Health Department that joined the Healthiest Cities and Counties Challenge, a nationwide initiative encouraging small to mid-sized cities, counties, and tribes to create positive health impacts in their communities. Lots more to talk about with Dr. Kennedy. Stick with us. We'll be back in just a moment. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People for Memorial Day weekend right after this news. Do you have tons of unwanted bills and personal papers hanging around you'd like to get rid of safely? Shred Cancer is a series of events to help you and your family protect yourself from identity theft. It's being held simultaneously at 3 Connecticut locations on Saturday, June 4th from 9 a.m. to noon. Stuff as many boxes as you can with personal paperwork to be shredded. Make your donation of $10 per box, and 100% of the proceeds go to the American Institute for Cancer Research. All the documents are shredded right in front of you to ensure the utmost in privacy and security. And the three locations for this event on June 4th are the Westfield Malls in Meriden and Trumbull and the Connecticut Post Mall in Milford. For information, call 203-303-8501 or visit proshred.com. We're pleased to be back with Dr. Byron Kennedy. He's Director of Health at the New Haven Health Department and Health Services. New Haven has joined the Healthiest Cities and Counties Challenge as an early adopter or innovator city with plans to significantly change the number of parents of children with asthma who smoke and reduce the number of children with asthma exposed to secondhand smoke and other pollutants and triggers. We already heard how Dr. Kennedy is looking at an innovative series of asthma camps for children to not only help educate them, but to put them in a situation with many peers to reduce the stigma of having asthma, and also a plan to enhance the professional development of all of the New Haven School District's nurses to be better equipped to understand and deal with children with the onset or maintenance of asthma. Dr. Kennedy, I understand that the New Haven Asthma Alliance is playing a critical role as a partner in helping you achieve these and some of the other plans that we'll talk about in the next few minutes. Can you tell us a little bit about how New Haven Asthma Alliance is sort of dovetailing with the City of New Haven Health Services to help you kind of jumpstart and accomplish these goals faster and better?
Certainly. You know, so one of the things that's been, you know, a challenge maybe for us is having information, you know, from the primary care provider's office, you know, about the action plan, or for that matter, knowing whether or not a child was hospitalized, let's say last week, you know, and then they this week are in school. Oftentimes, the information may not necessarily be known to the school nurse. And so one of the things that the Alliance has actually worked towards, you know, successfully, is being able to create a mechanism such that information can be shared. You know, so for example, being able to make asthma action plans available from pediatrician's office to the school nurses, so we know exactly what that is, and everybody's on the same page between the provider, the school nurse, and other folks who are working together as a team. The other thing that's been really helpful is creating a mechanism such that, you know, we can have, you know, information that gets to be shared about when a child was hospitalized or when they had an emergency room visit. So having access and read-only access to the electronic health record for those types of visits, it would be available to our school nurses so, again, they would have that information. Mm. Because if you have a kid who's in school this week and you knew that they were hospitalized last week, that would be more important for a school nurse to pay, if you will, closer attention to that child in terms of what's going on and seeing if they are having any difficulties post-discharge in terms of handling their medications or with breathing.
Mm.
okay. or certain triggers that might be at the school or elsewhere.
Okay. In your networking and in your professional circles, have you been able to find resources in fellow colleague health directors, whether municipal, county, or otherwise, or health agencies, either here in Connecticut in the region or somewhere else in the country, that, like New Haven, has been quite innovative in trying to attack the issue of asthma, particularly with its ties to smoking, secondhand smoke, and other environmental pollutants and triggers?
Yes, and I would say certainly some of our partners, not only here in this community, but even across the state and at the state level. Some of the statewide data that we have right now, for instance, allows us to focus our timing. So the fact that we're actually doing the summer camps and we're doing the pre-school year intensive training for the nurses, in part, derives from the statewide data, that shows that asthma hospitalizations peak early in the fall, specifically in the months of September and October, and that they're at their lowest in the months of July and August. So that actually helped us maybe choose maybe a more appropriate time in terms of how to do this intervention.
Okay.
We know that there's some good work using certain curricula like the Easy Breathing Program that's been, really had great success, in Hartford, but some of the other urban metro areas, here throughout the state, and we will be adopting, that type of curriculum as we think about what we train our nurses on. There's other programs that focus, if you will, maybe more on home triggers, such as the Putting on Airs program that is supported and funded by the state. So we will be using and incorporating that type of maybe knowledge and information into our overall strategies.
Excellent. Before we let you go, Dr. Kennedy, we've got one additional point that we'd like to make in the last couple of minutes that we have with you. And that is, according to the data that your office has provided us ahead of the interview, Connecticut is seeing about 400 non-smokers die every year, with the attribution for that death being in part or in total secondhand smoke. And this cuts across all demographics and ages and cultural borders. This is not just a childhood problem. This is a community problem that affects all ages. Can you talk briefly about how the New Haven Health Services is specifically or strategically focusing on trying to educate and separate folks that might be at risk from death or illness due to secondhand smoke, sort of shifting into the more adult and senior range of patient?
Certainly. So I think, tobacco is the leading cause of preventable death. It's a risk factor in this country, and certainly in this community as well. And, when we think about that, many people might suggest, oh, there's really nothing more to be done, in tobacco control. And yet, there are still opportunities. And I think New Haven has been maybe a leader in the state in terms of some of the steps that we've taken, including last year when we adopted, a tobacco-free New Haven policy that basically allows there to be more further restrictions on tobacco products, including e-cigarettes and smokeless tobacco. Specifically in the areas maybe of our parks and our governmental buildings, but also in our schools, so that actually helps restrict the use, but also with a focus on directing folks maybe who do have maybe addiction to tobacco and pointing them in the direction where they can actually get, help with being able to successfully quit long term. And then doing that maybe in such a way, such that we're helping to create an environment, that allows us to have, less complications from tobacco-related illnesses, including asthma. I mean, we don't know exactly what the cause is of asthma, but we do know that one of the main triggers is smoke. And we know from our data, that in about 25% of households, of asthmatic children, that there is at least one person who smokes in that household. So that's actually maybe creating an environment, where you're more likely to have exacerbations, and including going to the hospital or to the emergency room for an asthma just because of that environment from smoking.
Very good.
So to the extent that we can be successful in terms of actually changing the norms and reducing the smoking rates in this community, that creates a safer environment for everybody, including our children.
Well, we've brought it all the way back around to the beginning of our conversation, and it's a good place to wrap up for now. Dr. Kennedy, I hope you'll come back and talk with us again as we move into that sort of danger period in the fall to talk a little bit more about how successful the summer asthma camps were and the plans to roll out extensive professional development for school nurses. Dr. Byron Kennedy has been with us for this segment. He's Director of Health for the New Haven Health Department. The City of New Haven Health Department has joined the Healthiest Cities and Counties Challenge, a nationwide initiative encouraging cities, counties, and tribes to create positive health impacts in their communities. As an early adopter or innovator city, Dr. Kennedy and the City of New Haven is working on significantly changing the number of parents of children with asthma who smoke, to reduce the number of children with asthma who are exposed to secondhand smoke, as well as other environmental pollutants and triggers through the New Haven Asthma Alliance, a key partner. Dr. Kennedy, great to meet you and speak with you, and I hope to talk with you again soon. Thanks for calling in. Well, we're using the occasion to try to call you to support the 8th annual Center for Cancer Care 5K Walk and Run benefiting Griffin Hospital and their Center for Cancer Care to break down some stigmas. You know, our program, if you're a regular listener, has no embarrassment. We try to talk about important things no matter what area it's in. You know, the environment, mental health, health in general, any subjects, nothing's off limits. And today is what I think is an important show because we're breaking down some barriers in terms of individuals' potential embarrassment to talk about urological problems. And to some extent, we're also going to be focusing on urological cancers. No need to be embarrassed because it's all about getting you healthy if you are diagnosed with some sort of urological issue or dysfunction. And we have got a couple of experts in studio with us to help us do that today. We have got the first female urologist in the Valley at Griffin Hospital. Dr. Grace Biggs is with us, as well as Dr. Joseph Camilleri. Dr. Camilleri is board certified by the American Board of Urology and was named a top doctor in 2015 by Connecticut Magazine. He has a wealth of experience in urology with a focus on adult general urology. Dr. Biggs is the director of pelvic health, female pelvic medicine, and reconstructive surgery at Griffin Hospital. She practices all aspects of urology with a particular focus on female urology, including pelvic organ prolapse, incontinence issues, overactive bladder, non-invasive surgery, robotic surgery, and reconstructive pelvic surgery. I got through all that without being too embarrassed, so let's bring our listeners in on the subject. Dr. Biggs, as we kind of chatted a few minutes before we went on the air this morning, you were talking about how a lot of patients, particularly women patients, are very happy to see a woman being available to provide them with treatment at the now expanded urology practice at Griffin. Tell us a little bit about some of the things that you're seeing in terms of you know, some of the overarching concerns that you're dealing with in these early days of your arrival at Griffin.
Yes, well, I'm surprised by how much stone disease is here in the Valley in women. I've seen the greatest amount that I've seen ever. And so we take care of all aspects of stone disease, but also all kinds of issues that women often don't talk about openly and feel embarrassed to speak about, things like urinary incontinence, pelvic organ prolapse, which many women don't even realize other women suffer from it. And that's when female organs can herniate through the vagina. Mm. And that causes a lot of discomfort and quality of life issues like leakage, like pelvic pain, and also overactive bladder, which millions of people suffer, not only women, but men as well. And there's a lot of innovative surgery that's very non-invasive that we offer, and reconstructive pelvic surgery, but also office procedures that are very simple and painless and can offer huge improvements in quality of life.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say the advertising industry is equally not shy. We're seeing a lot of commercials about incontinence and either treatments or products to assist in that issue. So what are a few of the most important things that women particularly may need to know that would signal to them that they need to call upon a urologist for consultation?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the advertising, because if you notice, most of the advertising is about protective wear, like pads and diapers, and medicine. But when you come to a urologist, we want to educate you and let you know there's far more we can do, that you don't have to suffer with it and just be protected from having embarrassing moments, but we could possibly prevent it.
It's not just about
it.
Going out there and buying stuff.
Yes, we can prevent it and improve it where you may never have to buy those products anymore. Mm-hmm. And then there are other treatments that if the medicines fail, we can go further and improve life even more so. So...
Well, for women that are experiencing some discomfort or signs, should they potentially, go directly to a urologist, or should a patient's visit start with their general practitioner?
I think either is fine. Certainly, don't be embarrassed and mention any issues that you're uncomfortable with, whether it be leakage or... And that can be urinary leakage or fecal leakage as well. Yep. But please come see me first as well if that's what women would like to do. I'm happy to speak to them about everything, including even vaginal issues that women think that they have to live with these problems, that it's a natural part of aging. Mm-hmm. And I want to educate women that it's not the natural part of aging. Mm. It's issues that don't need to exist and can be improved.
Hmm. In terms of your training and continued professional development, doctor, is there a movement on the educational side of things to not only attack and treat these issues, but to also become more engaging about the prevention or the treatment, to sort of kind of do what we're trying to do today and break down these stigmas and these ideas that these are not things to be talked about?
Yes, and I think that's a general trend in medicine. We're trying to focus on preventive care, holistic care, and alternative care. And especially in urology, there's actually a subspecialty in female reconstructive pelvic surgery and pelvic health that I'm board certified in that. And that's just very recent in the last few years that board specialty has come about. So that's in urology, but I think in all of health, we're trying to focus on individual areas, but then as a general whole in the overall health of individuals.
Sure. Well, anyone with a urological issue that can be directly treated, the onset of a urological issue, male or female, is uncomfortable and serious, but perhaps nothing so serious as urological cancers. And so we'll give you a break and switch over to our friend, Dr. Joseph Camilleri. Dr. Camilleri, tell us a little bit about what you're seeing at Griffin in terms of the types of urological cancers that are impacting patients, not only in the Greater Nautic Valley, but from wherever they come to seek your expertise.
Sure. So one of the more common cancers we've been seeing is bladder cancer. And I think that has something to do with the fact that this area used to be a heavily industrialized area. And some of byproducts of industry are cancer-causing agents. And bladder cancer is one of the cancers that they cause. The other cancer we see a lot of is prostate cancer. And that's just a very common cancer that's seen everywhere,
but
seen in this area
globally
as well.
So in terms of diagnosis, certainly there are a number of pretty dangerous and invasive cancers that don't present to the patient. Is that similar with urological cancers, or is there pain, bleeding, something feeling wrong across the board virtually?
Yeah, so that varies from cancer to cancer. Prostate cancer usually will not have any symptoms until it's too late to cure. So prostate cancer is one that you have to look for, and the best way to look for it is to go for an annual physical and make sure you have the digital rectal exam and the PSA blood test done. Most of the time, if you have symptoms from prostate cancer, then it's too late to cure it. It can still be treated. Mm-hmm. Bladder cancer is different. Bladder cancer, the most common presentation is blood in the urine. And whether you can see it with your own eyes or it can be seen under the microscope, either one can be a sign of bladder cancer. So there again, going for a yearly physical and having a yearly microscopic urine test is very important in diagnosing bladder cancer. Mm.
Is that typically woven into the battery of tests a general practitioner or a someone's personal physician would request at the annual physical?
So the urine test is a standard part of the annual physical. The PSA test for prostate cancer is a very controversial issue at this point. Mm. And there are some agencies which recommend against PSA testing. Most of the agencies that are more medically oriented, like the American Cancer Society and the American Urologic Association, are more in favor of annual PSA testing, especially in men between 55 and 70.
Let's turn our attention to urinary tract infections, which can really have some interesting and disturbing side effects, particularly in older people.
Yes, often in older people, you will not get the typical symptoms of burning, suprapubic pain, cloudy urine. You may just get a change in mental status or dizziness or just slight behavioral changes.
Mm-hmm. How about prevention? Is that something similar to what folks need to do to avoid kidney stones? Is it about
yes,
hydration?
Yes, there are a lot of behavioral modifications, especially in postmenopausal women, but also in younger women as well. As women go through menopause, a lot of changes in the pelvic area occur that can be adapted or changed to improve vaginal health that then will help prevent UTIs.
Are there genetic predispositions or are UTIs carried through family lines?
There are certainly genetic predispositions, but most are not genetic.
Are there any particular types of lifestyle behaviors that individuals can subscribe to who may be predisposed to UTIs?
Sure. I think one of the most important things is to hydrate. When you drink a lot of fluids and you empty your bladder regularly, you don't allow the bacteria to sit and then allow growth because the bacteria stick to the bladder wall, which then allows the bacteria to become an actual infection. And also things like taking probiotics is also helpful as well, especially in women where that vaginal area is populated by lots of bacteria, good and bad. And the more good bacteria you can have there, the better.
Excellent. Dr. Camilleri, a final word on the issue of kidney stones. What is the treatment of preference that that you and Dr. Biggs are using at the Griffin Hospital?
So the treatment of the stone depends on the size of the stone and its location. As Grace had said, many times a small stone in the ureter will pass by itself. So sometimes the right treatment is just to watch. Stones that are too big to pass by themselves but are located in the ureter can be taken out by ureteroscopy, which is putting a telescope in the ureter and either basketing the stone or using a laser to break it up into smaller pieces. And then stones in the kidney are sometimes treated with what's called extracorporeal shockwave treatment, which is a treatment where a shockwave is generated outside the body and focused on the stone. The idea being to try and break the stone up into small pieces that will then pass by themselves.
Okay, great. Thank you. We'll pass the microphone over to our friend Christian Megger, who is also kind enough to not only arrange many of these interviews with the experts from Griffin Hospital and the Center for Cancer Care, but also is a great promoter of this walk. He's been involved with it. But Christian, I think every year this was kind of something that was established right around the time you came to Griffin, wasn't it?
Yeah, just about. I think it was about 4 years in when we started it. It was started in 2009 to celebrate the first anniversary of the Cancer Center's opening.
Great.
And it did start as just to be a walk to get the community out there to be healthy.
Excellent.
And the great thing about it is when I say this is a grassroots fundraiser, it really and truly is, because we really were just doing a little celebration. We're going to have a walk. We're going to have people get out, be healthy. Mm. And all of a sudden they came forward to us and they said, you know, I'd like to donate to this cancer center. It's so important to the Valley. It's so important to the area. As both the doctors have been talking today, you know, there's health issues in the Valley that folks want to go and they want to get treated right there in their backyard.
Right.
And the hospital, you know, put a lot of time and effort into making something that is truly beautiful, brings down the anxiety. Once you come in, it's almost like being at a spa, and it helps people relax. And so when they came to us and they said, you know, I want to donate some money, They made about, you know, $20,000 just with people coming forward. They didn't ask for donations. And we decided to make a 5K fund, which is sort of unique in the sense that a lot of these walks and runs will go towards like a capital campaign for a building. But this fund is particularly for the patients. It's for those special patient needs. It's for the patient who comes in and sees our social worker and goes, I'm not sure how I'm going to get to my treatments this week. I don't have a ride. And so right then and there, we're able to say, you know, your cab rides are on us. And when they come and they say, I'm having issues paying for our groceries, we hand them a card right then and there, paid for from this fund. We have free wig services, any sort of medical supplies that they need to help in their recovery, we cover right there. And also some of the complementary therapies that we give, such as, you know, we give out free massages there. We give out the Reiki treatments. We have a wonderful little spa-like setting where you can go and you can get therapeutic touch, all sorts of things. So it's really this race or this walk run is all for the patients, really.
Excellent. So we're out of time, but we do want to make sure folks know that not only is this a great, healthy way to get going in the Valley, there is also an incorporated food drive. 30% of Valley households live at or below the state's basic cost of living level, and food assistance is consistently one of the top requests of Valley residents to the state's 211 info line. So bring your non-perishable food items and personal care items along with you if you are inclined to participate. We also want to welcome youths. This year they're going to have a youth registration, which is only $10. Youth participants get a shirt and can participate in the event. Very exciting, and we'd like folks to make sure that they mark it on their calendars and come out Saturday, June 4th. Registration is open at 7:30. The event starts at 9. It's all happening out of the Center for Cancer Care at Griffin Hospital on Seymour Avenue in Derby. And Christian, it's griffinhealth.org/5K.
Yeah, it's the most happening website out there.
Okay. Second only to the Facebook page at Griffin Hospital Walk Run. Or you could always call 203-732-7431. Our guests have given us a great deal of information today. We hope we've helped break down some of the stigmas about urological health. Dr. Grace Biggs and Dr. Joseph Camilleri, as well as our good friend Christian Mager from Griffin Hospital and the Center for Cancer Care at Griffin Hospital in Derby. Thank you, folks, for being part of the program. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and don't necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.vocat, V as in Victor, O-K-E-T, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for another installment of the award-winning For the People, or listen to this and other For the People podcasts under the podcast tab on our station's website or on iTunes. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.